Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I'm Craig Parkinson, and this is the Two Shot Podcast. Pop the kettle on and let's dive in. How the devil are you? If my voice is deeper and lower than normal, it's because, let me have a look at the time, I get my phone here. It's exactly 25 past the hour of midnight. I've just got back from work, which is one of the reasons why, you know, I haven't been able to record regular episodes. But it's going to get easier to do that in the coming weeks, which is good news, isn't it? It's good news. And the other bit of good news is we've got a new episode this week. And I was able to do two things. I came back. I'm recording this from... That's my squeaky... Hear that? Squeaky trainers. I'm in Brighton at the moment, finishing off the last block of filming. So I'm going to be here for another 6 weeks or so. But I was lucky enough to go and catch the stand-up comedian, the brilliant stand-up comedian Nick Helm, on Sunday night. And we were going to record this prior to me seeing the show, which is called What Have We Become. It's on tour right now. You should definitely go and catch it. It's brilliant. It's a good night out. And I was coming back from Manchester on a Sunday and gave myself a lot of time. And, you know, there was a rail strike the day before, which I'm totally for, you know, give people what they need. But it did mess things up the day after, and it basically didn't give myself and Nick enough time prior to him jumping on stage in Brighton. So I said, you know what, let's leave it and let's try and catch up this week, because I wanted to try and record on the back of me seeing the show as soon as possible, because he's got a heavy touring schedule, I'm busy filming, and I need to get back recording podcasts, because you know how much I bloody love it. And yeah, it was one of those. Anyway, we sorted it, and I spoke to Nick this morning from his hotel room and from me here in Brighton, prior to my seaside walk along the beach, which I try and do every morning. Oh, it's incredible. I do love it. And it's a brilliant conversation. I'm so chuffed that he came on. I don't know if you know Nick, you'll know him either as stand-up. I first came across Nick on, it wasn't live at the Apollo. It was something else. I don't remember what it was, but he was unapologetic when he came out on stage, and it was, I don't want to say it was aggressive, but it was certainly, look, he wasn't backwards or coming forwards. He started off the routine that I saw, which I'm sure you may have seen, asking a certain member of the audience if they liked jokes. And he kept on asking if they liked jokes again and again and again and again and again. But the onstage, Nick Helm, and what you're about to hear, the offstage, Nick Helm, you know, they're two very different people. And he also starred in three series of what I think is, we can class it as a cult sitcom now. It's called Uncle. It's with Nick, the brilliant Daisy Haggard. And it's 10 years ago now. I think, look, if it's not on BBC iPlayer, it's definitely on BritBox. If you haven't seen it, I heartily recommend it. It is passionate, funny, angry. It's great. It's really, really good sitcom. But yet, Nick's show on tour at the moment, What Have We Become? Do go and see it. It'll be coming to a town near you, or if you've missed it, then, you know, catch up, jump in the car, go somewhere else. But this episode with Nick, myself and Nick had met before, only very briefly. We certainly hadn't sat down for an hour remotely. You know, it's always a bit difficult when it's remote. But this wasn't difficult at all. I wanted to do it in person, but I don't think we'd lost anything by doing it in this remote fashion. He is extremely honest, very, very open, and takes the reins with the questions that get thrown out there. And look, what I'm going to say is it does go quite deep with regards to mental health struggles and suicidal thoughts, antidepressants, medication. It's not bleak. It's not a bleak chat at all, but there's a certain portion, about two-thirds in, that we feel we need to have a chat about that and discuss it. And Nick's more than happy to do that. I handled it in a sensitive way. There's certain things we didn't talk about that I didn't think we needed to discuss. But also we talk about the mechanics of being a stand-up, when stand-up is taken away from you, as it has been for many stand-up comedians, how he builds a show, what he loves about being a stand-up comedian, all sorts. It's a brilliant lesson. It's a brilliant lesson, and I was so happy that he came on. And after, what have we had, like a three-week break? It's a cracker to come back to. So I'm going to have a little drink of my water, and I'm going to pack up because I've got a few days off. I'm going to get some more episodes booked in as soon as I can. And you know what? It'll be, we'll be back doing regular Thursday episodes very, very soon. But until then, please put your headphones on, slow down on that treadmill, enjoy the commute, whatever you're doing, and enjoy. This is the Two Shot Podcast with the brilliant Mr. Nick Helm. Enjoy. I'll see you at the end. Nick, morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm all right. But I'm not a touring comedian. I'm a jobbing actor, which means I'm not working till 3:30 this afternoon. But how is the tour going?
It's great. Yeah, it sort of started... I wasn't sure what it was going to be like when it started, you know.
In what way?
I wasn't sure what the audiences would be like, because this is the first time I've sort of like gone out and about since the pandemic. I did Edinburgh. Edinburgh was really lovely. I did a 1-hour show in Edinburgh, and with this I had to, you know, not I had to. In actual fact, I found the hour like more difficult to work out what to take out, because I knew I was going to go on tour, so it had to be like a 90-minute show with an interval in the middle. So Edinburgh was an hour, and then when I started the tour, it was just like, well, how does the new material fit back in? But, yeah, it's been lovely. It's been fantastic. People have been really nice, and I like meeting audiences afterwards. And, yeah, the whole thing's been brilliant, really. Yeah.
Well, I was lucky enough to see it in Brighton on Sunday night, and it was a really good crowd, and they were really going for it, because you don't really pull any punches.
It was a weird audience, though, wasn't it? On a Sunday, it was a Sunday night audience in Brighton, but they were like a Friday night audience, really. They were like very sort of. I don't think of it as heckling. I think people were just trying to sort of like join in, because they weren't trying to disrupt the show. They were just sort of trying to participate. But I've never seen anything like that on a Friday night, really. On a Sunday night. It was, but it was fun. It was a fun one. But they're not all like that. Some of them are like more like theatre shows, and then some of them are more like, well, I guess that was the only one that's been exactly like that.
Right.
It was fun. It was a fun one.
Can you tell as a comedian what an audience are going to be like within the sort of first 10 minutes, or whether you're going to have to work much harder to get them on side or not? Because the thing is, it's not like you're supporting, or, you know, they're taking a punt. They've bought tickets to come and see you, so you would already think that they would be fans of your work anyway.
A tour show tends to be people are only there because they want to be there. And when you're on a, like, when you're on a mixed bill, I find mixed bills really stressful. Like on a, like it, as a jobbing club comedian going on stage, the audience have already really enjoyed three other comedians, and then you've got to go on and kind of like, and you're in the green room going, I'm nothing like any of them guys. And then you've got to go on and match that. I find that stressful. Not that I can't do that, but like, I just find the whole build up to that quite stressful. But when you're on tour, I kind of just remind myself that they're there to see me. And then when I go out, if anyone does have a problem, it's kind of like it's up to them to leave, really, I think.
Yeah.
Because literally everyone else is there for it. Last night, I came on stage, I was in Birmingham, and I came on stage, and there was a guy with his phone on his knee, and it was all lit up. And it was the very first thing that happened when I came out on stage. He had his phone, and he put his phone down, but he didn't switch it off. And I was just like, what's going on here? And he was bidding on a rucksack on eBay. And
fucking hell.
And he had like 12 minutes left on the thing. And at first you're kind of like, oh my, what's why are you here? But then he became like a running joke throughout the night, and it was just a really, really fun one in the end. And I started the show differently from how I normally do because of this guy. And then it just made the whole show a lot looser, and it was fine. So I think that if 99% of the audience are on side, there's always going to be some people that are dragged along by their friends or their partners and stuff. But as long as 99% of the audience are on side, I think you can kind of win people over.
You see, that's the difference as a comedian. Now, as an actor, if you're doing a piece of theatre and someone's texting and it just pings and lights up, you can't exactly stop the play and go, can you get off your fucking phone and pay attention? That can be really distracting. And no matter how many times I go to the theatre, people put their phone on silent or sometimes not, or let it ring and sometimes answer it. And there's like nothing you can do there. Even if you're sat there as an audience member or whether you're on stage.
Yeah, you do have quite a lot of freedom as a comedian to do that. But on the flip side, when you're in a play and you're in theatre, there's more than you on stage, so it's not so much of a personal insult, you know? It's kind of like they're insulting all of you in a way. When there's one guy that just won't switch his phone out and you're going like, I've travelled to Birmingham for this, and he's just like, and he gives so little of a shit about it that he can't even be bothered to switch his phone off. It was not even switching his phone off, Craig. It was not just sort of like making the screen go dark. It was just like, wow. So, it's more of a personal insult, I suppose. But then you have like the ability to kind of deal with it as and when. So, I don't know. There's good and bad, isn't there?
Yeah, no, of course. But Nick, for you, let's go back. So what came first for you? Because was it music or was it comedy or was it acting? Because at the moment, I know, because you do all three.
Yeah, to various degrees of ability and success, but yeah, when I was young, I was very like creative in general, and I guess I never really picked one, and then I still haven't really, and that's good in some ways because you know I'll do a tour, and then when I finish this tour, I've got an album coming out, and depending on when this is out, it'll be out already. It's coming out on Halloween, and then I might concentrate on some music then, or I might concentrate on actually just writing and trying to get my screenplay finished and all of this stuff. But I guess what I started out doing was I wanted to act and I wanted to sing, and I always wrote songs when I was, a sixth former, and at school when I started like learning guitar and stuff, I used to write songs to help me do that. And then I went up to Edinburgh when I was 20 and I wrote my first show when I was 20, and I really started writing because I was so shit at auditions, and I was just like, I'd never got any parts. I got so nervous and overwhelmed by it that I just started writing stuff for myself to perform. And then I'd like direct theatre and write theatre. And then that became like very sort of like difficult to... It's like theatre's like... When you're like doing independent theatre, that's like being in a band where you're kind of like convincing five other people that your idea is worth pursuing. Mm-hmm. And then I got to a point, the story is that I'd spent about 7 or 8 years writing a play. I took it up to Edinburgh. Due to a printing error, it got a 1-star review. It was from the Scotsman, and the Scotsman phoned up the theatre and they said, oh, there's been a printing error, you've got a 1-star review. But it was actually meant to be a 2-star review. And I think if it had been a 2-star review, people would have just ignored it. But because it was 1-star, people came to watch this car crash. And it went all right. But at the end of that, I was just like, if you can spend 7 years writing something and in 3 seconds you can accidentally give it a 1-star review, then I'll see what stand-up comedy is like. And it was always one of those things that I wanted to try. So when I started doing stand-up comedy, that sort of like scratched that itch of kind of like writing and directing and performing and all of that. And then when I had to do 20 minutes, I only had 15 minutes, so I added a song into it, and then that bumped up. And then everyone liked the song more than all the stand-up. And then, I became kind of like a stand-up comedian that did music. And then in 2011, Henry Normal came to see me in Edinburgh. And after that, he put me in Uncle. And then now I'm an actor.
Do you think years ago, from the outset, it always seemed to me to be that stand-ups, and I'm going back a fair few years, would go to Edinburgh and their goal was to be seen, like, you know, by people like Henry or some Channel 4 execs, so then they could get their own sitcom. And I'm not saying for everybody, but it seemed to be quite popular at that time.
I think that's definitely... it's changed so much in the last 10 years. And I'd say the 10 years before that, I think stuff like Life at the Apollo changed the possibilities of what you could do with a career in stand-up comedy. You'd go from being kind of like a working, jobbing comedian to being a household name overnight. And in the early 2000s, you could sell out a tour just by one performance on... or, so we've been led to believe, you could sell out a tour from one performance on Live at the Apollo. And but there were only like five comedians, you know, in the country. And then when it became kind of like a legitimate way of becoming a superstar, then people became a lot more interested. You know, there's degrees, there's university degrees that you can do in stand-up now, where you pay loads of money to spend 3 years. I don't know what the course is. I don't know what you'd learn on a stand-up comedy degree, really, unless you're learning about the history of stand-up, which I guess I would find really interesting. But yeah, I think that there's nothing, you can't really beat just getting out there and doing it and dying on your ass night after night until you get good, you know.
And did you, in the early days when you were out performing stand-up, did you know what the goal was, as in terms of I was going to be me, or I was going to be a version of me, or I was going to be a sort of slightly more grotesque character? Or because I don't ever think that any stand-ups are 100% themselves. I always feel they're a version.
It's like a persona. Like, it's a persona that you kind of like. It's not like I've got to get in character. It's sort of like a switch that you flip, and then, you know, when I'm off stage, I'm one thing, and then as soon as I go on stage, I'm another thing. But I've had to be, because my act is so kind of, not aggressive, but my act is so extreme in terms of personality-wise to me. I've always had to be very careful about who I am on stage and who I am off stage. So I'm always very sort of like polite with people and mild-mannered with people and you know, to let people know that this is different from what's on stage and, you know. What's the question?
I suppose in the early days, did that come fully formed to you that you were going to be this? I mean, you said it there. I mean, it's not an aggressive persona, but he's... I remember in the early days when I first saw it, I thought, fucking hell, this guy's... He's certainly not backwards or coming forwards. Did that come to you quite quickly, or was it a bit falling on your arse and failing?
I guess, like, through theatre, when I wrote theatre, I used to write about emotions and depression and stuff like that. And so I sort of had an idea of what I was on stage before I started doing stand-up. But when I first started doing stand-up, I sort of wanted everyone to like me. So I'd go on and I'd be all like, hello, how are you all doing? Oh, isn't everything wonderful, guys? And it was sort of like, it was all right. But I'd written quite a lot of material and I just basically realised that I didn't know how to perform it. So I took a year, I think about 2008, 2009, I stopped writing stand-up. And I just was like, I've got loads of stand-up, how do you perform it? And I just worked on how to perform it. And I think kind of like I'd had, you know, a couple of specific gigs in my mind where the audience were kind of apathetic and there was 10 acts on. Well, I'll tell you what, when I first started, there'd be kind of like, you'd do like a laughing horse gig in central London, and I lived in St Albans with my parents, so I'd travel into London, and it'd be a Sunday night, and it'd be rainy and cold and miserable, and you'd go to like this pub, and there'd be three audience members, and 10 comedians, and every comedian wanted to be Stuart Lee, and they'd all go on and do Stuart Lee, and because that's so low energy, the night would kind of like really struggle, and so I would always sort of like take it upon myself to like bring the energy in the room, and I'd go out and I'd do it, and everyone would be like, "Oh, that was really great," and he'd be like, "Yeah, but it's not what I want to be, Stuart Lee, too, do you know?" And and so it was kind of like. So I kind of got a name for myself, I guess, by just being kind of like a person that put energy in the room. And then later on, when I kind of like was doing all right, I could kind of like take a step back and think about who I actually wanted to be on stage. And then I could kind of like put it together that way. My goal as a comedian on stage is I've never tried to be cool, and I'm not trying... I'm not trying to be likable, and in the past it's been kind of like a bit more of a caricature or a character, like even like 6 years ago, I think I kind of like it would be like this heightened huge performer, and then over the last few years this is the third show that I've done in a row that's been sort of like talking about me on a personal level. Mm. Whereas before it would be kind of like general stand up, you know, where you're talking about general things and themes like dreams and war and I did a show about Evel Knievel, and that was maybe a little bit more personal, but now I'm just kind of like laid bare and stuff, and that's kind of like being guided by my audience as well. I have a really good relationship with my audience, and I would talk about depression in the past, and people would ask me about it, and then I would talk to them about it, and then I found that my audiences found it really comforting or useful for me to talk about that on stage. And then when I did Live at the Apollo, I talked a bit about depression, and people took it out of context, and they got not loads of people. It was probably about three people, but it stuck with me, and I was just like, right. So the last three shows I've done, I've tried to sort of like put my, you know, lay my table out and just be sort of like, this is where I stand on mental health and depression, and I'm writing comedy about it, but I'm not making fun of it. And, you know, one of the most, you know, my first goal is to make people laugh and to have a nice night out and to enjoy themselves. I don't feel like the best way to do that is to just tell everyone that everything's all right. And so I sort of like try and take people through kind of like an emotional journey where you kind of like you bring them down and then you bring them up again. It's very important to do that last bit. And then I really sort of, I found that the more honest I was about myself, the more people related to it. And so first and foremost, I want to be funny. And then secondly, I want people to find some sort of comfort in it, and I want to start conversations on the way home, you know? So if people come and see me and I talk about depression, I talk about antidepressants, and I talk about whatever experience I've been through, then it opens up conversations for people on the way home to start, gives them like a helping hand to start conversations on the way back. You know, I mean, you were in Uncle, and Uncle basically does that as a sitcom. It's kind of like, I didn't write it, but one of the reasons I wanted to do it was that it was about stuff that meant a lot to me. And I get people coming up to me all the time saying that, you know, they watched Uncle and it helped them through a really difficult part of their life. And that for me is the most fulfilling thing about doing what I've, you know, my body of work so far. That is the most fulfilling thing about it, is the fact that it's really helped people. And it's funny, you know, and I think that that's, if I've got one job, then that's it, you know, is to sort of like, I don't know, make people laugh, but also kind of like help people a little bit.
But you do, and I think why people connect
with, because I don't want to give it away because I want people to go and I do want to see you on tour, even though that's not what we do on this podcast, but I do want people to go and see it because it's a fucking fantastic show. But what you do, which I think is lovely and it's delicate, is you don't preach. It's not preachy because there's a certain moment towards the end of this show where you do talk openly and quite personally about some subjects, and you bring it quite down. And it's a lovely personal moment that people can emotionally connect with. And it isn't preachy. Mm. I find sometimes, because, you know, you touched on Uncle there, and there were certain topics in that show going back a fair few years before it was, and I don't want to poo-poo it when I say this, before it was fashionable to be talking so openly and honestly about mental health.
Yeah, I think people will look back on Uncle and realise that it was ahead of its time. It did lots of things that are very, you know, popular now. You know, it's getting on for 10 years ago now. But I would also say that with the live performance stuff, that is trial and error. I think part of my last show is called Phoenix from the Flames, and I felt like I hadn't quite grasped how I wanted to get the message across. So when the pandemic came and I had to cancel that tour, I was actually sort of relieved because I don't think it was 100% preachy, but I do feel like for me on a personal level, it was just bordering on the wrong side of that, where I don't have all the answers. And it would be disingenuous of me to go on. It would be ridiculous if I went on stage and said, "I've got all the answers, guys, follow me." but all you can do is like set an example of being kind of like, I'm just going to be open about my problems, and I'm not going to hide away. And I'm not saying that this should be kind of like everyone's daily life is to walk around like an open wound, but for the hour and a half I'm on stage, you know, I'm kind of like demonstrating that you can come on stage and you can do that, and people can still kind of like find you funny and likeable and all these other things. And I don't know, it's just kind of like, go on stage, and if I say it out loud, then maybe it'll help them say it out loud. But that's where I feel like comfortable, you know, whereas in my last show, I felt like it was just erring on the side of preachy. Like, I've solved it. I used to be depressed, and now I'm not. Mm. And I've fixed myself. Although I probably need to rewatch that show, because I don't really think that wasn't the message. But I feel like it was a step closer to being kind of like, hey, I'm all sorted now. And and one of the things that I learned, or I kind of came to terms with in lockdown, was that I think that my mental health issues and depression and all of that stuff, that's not something that I'm necessarily going to solve. But that was actually quite freeing, because then it came down to, well, if you're going to be with this thing for your whole life, then how are you going to cope with it? And then it became about working out how to cope with these issues. And then that was actually, rather than being like a negative, like, oh, I'm stuck with this thing, it was more like, okay, great, well, we're in it together, me and my brain, so how are we going to get through it all together? And I found that kind of comforting in a way.
And I suppose freeing as well, to know, yeah. And it's a bit like what you talk about in the show towards the end is, it, you know, it is trial and error. Like, medication is trial and error. Maybe this path is not for you, but this road is comforting and could help you in some way.
Yeah. Well,
when did you first realize? Because, you know, we all get down and we all suffer from anxiety sort of now more than ever. But, you know, depression, you know, rears its ugly head in various different ways. But when did you realize that it was depression, and it wasn't just some sort of mood or small bit part of anxiety?
Well, again, it's ever evolving thing where it's difficult, isn't it? Because like, I think I was talking to a friend maybe a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, but not very long ago, and she was talking about anxiety, and I was just like, well, what's that then? And then she sort of described what anxiety was, and I was like, well, I've got that. And I think kind of like for a long time, I lumped everything into this one category, which was depression.
Mm.
And then there's bits of OCD mixed in with that. And that kind of like opened up this whole kind of avenue to sort of like explore where it was just like, oh, hang on a minute. I'm sort of like dealing with all these conflicting feelings and it's like a whirlwind in my head sometimes. And actually it's quite good to sort of like separate things out and go kind of like, well, that's you just sort of like with your OCD, just running things round and round and round in your head. And then that's kind of your anxiety because you're sort of like, you know, you can't leave your flat. And so I don't think I've got to the end of the journey, and I don't think that's what I'm sort of like saying. I think what I'm saying in the show is that I'm sort of like on a journey and I'm sort of exploring it. And these are the things that personally have helped me. I don't say do what I do. I sort of like just say that kind of like, this is what I've been through. And if you can take anything good from that, then take it. But
also you're finding your tools to help you along with the journey.
Yeah, and chemically everyone's made up differently. You know, it's like the first drug that I was put on was sertraline, and that really fucked me up for you know about 6 months where I was having suicidal thoughts, and I kept talking to the doctor and saying, like, these are making me worse, and he kept saying, like, oh, just give it another two weeks. And it was just like, this is much worse, much, much worse than it was when I wasn't taking them. And so I had to sort of, like, really, like, argue with the doctor and say that this isn't what I want, this isn't for me, and convince them that I wanted something else, which is ridiculous. But like having that conversation with my friend like a year and a half ago, that just came about just through us talking together. And then I was just like, oh, and then I found a new avenue of something to explore and to discover. And so my first thing would be if you're suffering from anything, talk to people and tell people what it is that you're going through. Get on a waiting list for a therapist from the NHS and talk to them, talk to your GP, talk to your friends and your family. My family are not the best people to talk to about depression. You know, they and one of the things that I've learned through therapy is that, you know, you have to accept people for who they are and what they are, and you can't be angry with them for not being what you want them to be.
Yeah.
And my mum and dad are brilliant. But they don't know. They get scared and they get lost when it comes to depression, and I try and sort of like avoid talking to them about like the really big stuff. Whereas I've got a couple of friends who have been really, really kind of amazing and helped me find kind of avenues to sort of like help myself with. And then also my girlfriend's been incredibly supportive and incredible. And, you know, we met during the pandemic and I thought I was all right. And then I kind of like had an absolute kind of car crash, and she's been, and right from the beginning, she's kind of like been completely there for me and supported me. But it's not like when I say go out and talk to people, it's not everyone will be there and will be able to help you.
No, absolutely not. I agree.
But it's about kind of like, it's about educating yourself and teaching yourself and kind of like working out through trial and error what's what and who's what. And when I drew that line in my head about what my family are capable of and what they're not capable of, then it improved my relationship with my family. You know, I wasn't just there like going, oh, I, Why can't you see what's wrong with me? Why can't you, you know, I was just like, oh, we're going out for a bit of Sunday lunch today. Right, okay. And I sort of like managed to deal with things like that.
I mean, with things like that, with talking to parents about sort of deep topics and personal topics like that, I sometimes think it could possibly be a generational thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think there is a lot of anxiety in the world now. I think that there's lots of reasons for that. I think, you know, I think social media isn't kind of like a coincidence, and it's stuff that our parents didn't have to deal with and only deal with in a very superficial kind of distant level, right? It doesn't rule, their lives. And so I think it is a little bit difficult for them to relate sometimes and for them to understand. And that's not really... That's not really their fault, and also for some people, their parents will be the best people that they can talk to. So it's we're all different, you know. We're all different in terms of like our relationships with people in our lives and who we know and what we've got, and we're also different in terms of the chemical makeup of our brains and everything, and so. So it's kind of like literally you can't go out there and say, oh, I've got mental health issues and this is how to solve them. But it is kind of like I've got mental health issues and this is how I'm tackling them. Mm. Yeah. And I think that the more people talk about it, the other thing is, even if you take nothing away from the show, just going out and talking about it like it's normal is a big help in general, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just kind of like, you know, I with this show, rather than, you know, giving a big dramatic build-up and a reveal in the third act that, and then, dear reader, it turned out I suffered from depression, you know, I come out and I say it right at the start of the show. It's almost sort of like a crazy way to start a show, because you'd come out and I start talking about antidepressant medication that I'm on, and it's kind of like, well, this isn't kind of like a real kind of like crowd pleaser, is it? But it's always gone well, and
yeah,
and once I've dealt with it, I can just do the rest of the show and sort of and get on with it. And I think normalizing it, if you're not giving like specific advice, which I wouldn't ever want to give out like specific advice, but just by going out and talking about it, you know, you're setting an example for people that is all right.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Nick, you touched on before about possibly going back and watching the last show. Are you quite sort of forensic in your approach about going back and watching the show and seeing what worked and seeing what you want to fix? Because I would have thought that, well, that's quite specific to that show. Yeah. If it's gone, there's kind of nothing you can change. Or is it more about your approach to a joke or how you deal with an audience, about what you can learn to take forward into the next shows?
No, I think that each show is its own thing. And I once I've finished the show, I draw a line under it, I forget about it. And then this show, I mean, my last show was written before the pandemic, and this show was written after a 2-year break. I found my last show incredibly stressful mentally, because I was talking about mental health issues, and I felt, like I said, I felt like I was erring on the wrong side of preachiness, and whether I was or not, I don't know, but like, I knew that that's not what I wanted to do. But also, when we cancelled the tour because of the pandemic, I was so relieved, and I didn't want to do stand up. And when the pandemic, it was weird, wasn't it? Because it was like we're in very competitive industries where there are only so many jobs for a lot of people, and with comedy, it's kind of like Edinburgh's every year. You kind of like getting this, it's like a school year, you know, and Edinburgh's your exams. And then throughout the year, you're kind of like getting ready for your exams. And then you pens down at the beginning of August, you do your show, and then you get reviewed. And then in the autumn, you go on tour. And then in January, you start kind of writing a new show again. And it's, if you took an Edinburgh off, you'd feel like everyone was overtaking you. And so even if you took a break, it would be incredibly stressful because you'd just be thinking about all the things that you weren't doing and all the people that were overtaking you and doing all this. And I've always tried to, you know, I've always tried to sort of like not compete, you know, and just do my thing. And my thing is so different from everyone else anyway that mm-hmm. it's just sort of, not like there is no contest, but it's just like you can't really compete with this because it's different. So I've always just tried to just do my own thing, but you get sucked into being competitive, and it's not a good state of mind for me to be in. And so when the pandemic hit, although it was terrible on a lot of levels, you got to kind of look at the global thing and the personal thing. And on a personal level, the fact that everyone had to stop kind of meant that it was possible. It was like the first break I'd had in 20 years, you know, and wow. like mentally. And I kind of needed it. And then after I'd sort of like healed for a little bit, month, and I eventually started wanting to do stand-up again, but I'd got to a point where I didn't want to do it, and then when the restrictions got lifted, my first goal wasn't write a tour show. My first goal was just scrape something together so you can say it on stage. And so the tour show, you know, superficially ended up being like a greatest hits of my favorite routines that I've done since we've all been allowed out again. And mm-hmm. then the framework is, you know, looking back on the last few years, but the actual content of the show is stuff that I've really enjoyed, you know, like I've got like specific set pieces. I've got a bit about HelloFresh, and I've got a bit about Prince Andrew, and I've got a bit about being on an airplane and comparing it to the pandemic. And and those were all like chunks that I really enjoyed. And then it's about putting them in a framework where it works, where it all sort of like tries to flow together.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's kind of like bookended with this story about my family, which I wrote specifically for Edinburgh. I think I wrote that during the first week when I was in Edinburgh, because I got up to Edinburgh with all these bits and I was just like, I don't have a beginning or an end. So I wrote the beginning and I was like, now I need an end. And then I wrote I wrote the end, and I was just like, how do you set the end up? So then I wrote the beginning, you know. But and the, you know, the bit about Hitler's dad, that wasn't in the Edinburgh show, but that was like a really fun bit of material that I didn't really have a place for. And everyone was like, well, you've got to put that in the show. And when I did Edinburgh, I just took it out because it was the only bit that wasn't really about anything. And then when I was on tour, you put it back in again. And it's just like, great, it's a crowd pleaser. Everyone likes that bit. And and so really, it's kind of like you look at a show as like a piece of theatre, and you kind of like go, right, it's got this story that goes through it, and it's got a beginning and a middle and an end, and it's all very, but in terms of kind of like putting this show together, it was like Lego. It was just like, this is a bit that I like, and this is a bit that I like, and this is a bit that I like, and how'd you construct it all? Whereas the last show was I think very much kind of like, this is my journey through a thing. And it started off as kind of like, how do I tell this story?
Being specific about Edinburgh, you touched on there how you didn't really have that certain start or that certain end, and you're just going to try and write it when you get up there. That's quite a scary prospect to go up there for a month. Is that do you normally work like that?
Yeah, I would say. Well, in the early days, when I did something like my first like big, well, I tell you what, the year before that in 2009, I was meant to do a show with two other comedians who dropped out right at the last minute, and when I tried to cancel the show because it was under my name, They wouldn't let me, and they said, "Your name, you'll never work for PBH ever again." And if you know PBH, it's kind of like, it's the free fringe, and it helps a lot of comedians start out. Mm. But at the time, I felt like I was going to be blacklisted, and that was the end of my career. And so I'd written poems and songs in the past. So basically, I just took a bunch of poems that worked and a bunch of songs that worked, and then I came up with a couple of routines. And I did it in a very short amount of time, maybe a month, and I went up to Edinburgh, and the show sort of evolved for like the first... It's a bit like a house sort of like expanding, and it found its kind of like place after a few days. And then that was just a really good show, and I put it together very, very quickly. And then when I did 2010... I was previewing that, but I was like doing stuff with props, and I had sort of like a musician friend who was on stage with me, played guitar, and it was just there were all these elements to it that, and plus it's kind of like I need a song, so I'll write a song and I'll spend a day or 2 days writing a song, but at the end of doing that, you've written a 4-minute song. And you haven't written 56 minutes of stand-up, yeah? So it's just like, well, what? Okay, the song's great, but it's just like, what do I do with the rest of the time? Mm. And so previews were always just a nightmare. You'd kind of try and do a couple of previews, and then it'd be like, well, that doesn't work, and that doesn't work, and whatever. And I think some people everyone's different, everyone works differently. Some people preview it until they're happy with the show, and then they go, right, that's the show. And then they take it up to Edinburgh. But I'll preview it until I kind of like go, I think I've got the basic gist of it. And maybe the last, in 2010, my last preview was rubbish, but I knew what didn't work, and then I knew what did work. And then I took it up to Edinburgh and I did it. And then also on the first day, there was like 4 people in the room. And I used to do a thing where I'd sing, "Nice to meet you, nice to greet you. Nice to say hello," and I'd get an audience member out, and then I'd say, "Nice to meet you, nice to greet you, nice to meet you, nice to greet you, and nice to meet you, nice to greet you, nice to say hello," and then I say hello, and they say hello, and then they say their name, and then I go, "Great," and that was it. And I was going to work with them on, you know, throughout the hour, there'd be an audience member who'd be like helping me out, and that's what I went up to Edinburgh with. But on the first day, there was 4 people in the audience. And it was just like, well, it's a bit weird just taking one person out. So I got like everyone out of the audience on stage, and we all met each other, and I put them back. And then the next day, there was 10 people in the audience, and I got them all out. And then at the end of the week, there was like, it was filled. You know, there was like, people were coming up to me in the streets going, "Apparently you get everyone on stage." And I was just like, yeah. And it became its own sort of like marketing thing. It was like, when people say there's word of mouth, you know, you're not really in the loop on that, because people are talking about you, not to you.
Mm.
But there was like this word of mouth about that show, because I'd got all these people up on stage, and every day I'd get like 80 people up on stage, and one at a time, or like chunks at a time, and there'd always be one person left in the audience that would be the audience member. And that's the thing that literally came together throughout the first week of being up in the festival. And it was the best, maybe not the best thing about the show, but it's one of the things that made that show stand out.
Mm.
And you know, TV people came to see that. That's what got me my job on Russell Howard's Good News, which made me a headliner. Sort of, I went from kind of like being like a middle spot to being like a headliner. And when you get up there and you realise that so much of it is just all to chance anyway, you know, it's about kind of like what I try and do is I try and get all the bits for a car together, and then I take it up to Edinburgh, and then I assemble the car when I'm in the venue. And I think that's how I kind of try and do it. And if I need sort of like a new bit, then I'll write it. But I'm not like writing the show. I'm kind of like going, there's a little gap there that isn't clear enough for like this bit to work later on. So now I'm going to fill that gap with that bit. I've got a message that I want to say, and I don't know how to fit it into the show. So it's about working out the logistics of how to do it all. And it does change when you're in the room. Yeah, and so I think when that happens, you're serious about writing the show, but in terms of constructing the show and putting a show together, you have to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt.
Mm-hmm.
And also kind of like, you might have the best material ever, but you do it in front of the most ungrateful audience that you've ever seen. And like, I've had gigs where they've been going so badly that, like, even within the last year, where I've kind of gone, I've got a really good bit coming up now and I'm not going to do it because I like it. And if I do it in front of you,
you don't deserve it.
You're going to make me hate it. You're going to make me doubt it. Like, next time I do it, I'm going to be thinking, is it any good? So I'll be kind of like, I'll do all my B, C material, but I'm not giving you the A stuff because you don't know what to do with it. So there's kind of like a bit of that, you know. First and foremost, I think it's really fun. I really enjoy putting a show together and I don't think I've ever said that in any interview. I've always kind of like been kind of a little bit like ponderous about it. But what I find putting a show together and making it work, that's the really fun bit. And I enjoy it, you know.
Well, it really sounds to me like your love of stand-up is back and thriving. If we went back at the early stage of the pandemic where you didn't want to get up and do it again.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're firing on all cylinders there, that the passion and the love is where it needs to be.
Yeah. But I think that, a lot of that is the audience, you know. I love going out there and I love doing a show and I love doing the merch. You know, I sign merch at the end and I always say, you know, you don't have to buy anything. You can just say hello if that's what you want. And that's like a really important part to me. And the whole evening is kind of like really special. So to go out and meet people again and kind of perform in front of audience. I've enjoyed doing club gigs since I've come back. You know, when you're on a mixed bill where, you know, you're one of five comedians, and that's the sort of stuff that before the pandemic, it would terrify me. I'd get really stressed about it. And I think one of the important things that I've done since the pandemic was I've kind of come to terms with the fact that I am a stand-up comedian. I've gone, right, this is my job. This is what I do. You probably, after the pandemic, I needed to make some money. And it was just like, what's the quickest way to make some money? Oh, well, I can get a gig tonight and I could go out and do it. The only problem is I don't want to do it. So how do I make myself want to do it? And so after the pandemic, I spent like a couple of months, you know, just going out there and doing gigs and retraining and reteaching myself how to do stand-up and how to enjoy it. And I went from kind of like dreading club gigs to kind of like going back out there and just really making the most of them and really enjoying them. And in the past, I've really managed to split rooms where some people love me and some people hate me, and I'll be having a great gig and a bad gig at the same time, to kind of like lowering that percentage so that more people were enjoying it. I'm kind of like being more instinctive about it, and I've taught myself how to just sort of like, if I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life, I better fucking start enjoying it. And so, so I've taught myself how to enjoy it, and I love it now, and it's brilliant, and it's sort of like such a weird distant memory to think it's something that I didn't want to do, you know.
Mm.
But it was a couple of years ago.
So. Why did you shy away from calling yourself a stand-up comedian or admitting to yourself that you were a stand-up comedian? Was it through embarrassment or you didn't feel legit or...?
No, I think it was because I found it hard. It was really difficult. It was not doing it. I'm all right when I'm on stage. As soon as I get on stage, even if it's a bad gig, as soon as I'm on stage, you know what you're dealing with. But it's waiting all day to get on stage and not knowing. And so I would have... I would have a gig coming up and it would be like an app running on you'd be low level stressed about it. And then the closer it would get when I first started doing stand-up comedy, if I had a gig, I would be nervous for 2 weeks before the gig. And then it got down to about an hour. And now I'm doing it, or my goal for doing it, I didn't do club sets for about maybe 6 years. I would do Edinburgh every year, I'd be doing telly, and I couldn't do Edinburgh. And my show, when I did a 20, my 20 consisted of, there's 5 one-liners, then I do a song, then I do a bit of audience participation, then I do a poem, then I do a story, then I do another song, then I do some more one-liners, and it was just like, there were so many elements for me to remember, I would just freak out about, oh my God, I'm going to forget something or whatever, what if it goes wrong? And then you start planning for plan B rather than plan A, and go, well, if I get that bit wrong, then maybe if I do that, and you go like, why am I learning plan B when I should just be concentrating on plan A? And it's just kind of like, there were so many elements to it that it was overwhelming to me. And then when I came back to it after the pandemic, it was just like, right, okay, throw all that out. I need to remember 3 things, yeah? I need to remember Pepsi Max Cherry, Sainsbury's and HelloFresh, and I can do 20 minutes with those 3 things and that will earn me whatever money for that night, you know? And I can just go up. I don't have to think about it at any point throughout the day. Don't have to build up to it all through the week. I probably think about it 5 minutes before I go on stage, and then I walk on stage and I do it. And it wasn't about generating material. It was about making the material I had work. And it was about being comfortable with just getting up and doing it. And that's what this show is sort of like made from. It's made from routines that I just found really enjoyable, really straightforward, really easy to remember. And I'd just go out and I'd do it. And it wasn't like song lyrics where it's just, I freak out about song lyrics. Mm. I write songs, but I find remembering the songs incredibly difficult. And I've got a really terrible memory with that stuff. But with stand-up, it's not like I've written a script and I've learned it. It's conversational, and you say it sort of fairly similar every single day until you get like the pattern sort of sorted in your head, and then you remember it like that way. I wouldn't say that I was embarrassed about being a stand-up comedian, but I would say that I found it really, really, really difficult. And when I started doing telly, I was just like, not that I find that easy, but you don't have that immediate pressure of getting up in front of a room full of people and trying to make them laugh. And it was kind of like, I found like acting kind of, it was something that I've always wanted to do, but also it's a different sort of stress. It's a different pressure that isn't necessarily about, I don't know, like TV acting is different from theatre acting as well, but it's kind of like, I found that also Uncle was just the most supportive environment that you could have done it under. And so I sort of like found my way over the series to work out what it was, how to do it, I suppose.
Yeah. No, I'm only asking about feeling legitimate, because and not that this is about me, and it never is, but in my 20s I used to be embarrassed to call myself an actor, and I know many other people that are like that, because they don't feel legitimate. And over the years you just go, oh, actually I think I've kind of earned my stripes now. And not that I want to go around with a megaphone saying it, but certainly if someone asks me at a party, I'm not gonna pretend that I have another career.
I think that like it's imposter syndrome, isn't it? And you're kind of, well, I'm an actor, but I'm going to get found out one day that I'm not an actor, and everyone's going to realize that I'm not an actor, and it's going to be, with comedy it's slightly different, because when you're at a wedding and you bump into someone and they say, what do you do for a living, and you say I'm a comedian, if you say you're an actor, they don't say, go on then, do us a bit of Hamlet joke. But when you're a comedian, it's like, I'll tell us a joke. So there is kind of like a thing where you just sort of like, you frame it differently. You say, oh, I'm a writer, you know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, or, I mean, I, yeah. So I think there is kind of like...
No, but what they do say when you say I'm an actor is, what would I have seen you in?
Yeah, right. And then that's and always sort of like, you get people that recognise you who come up to you and say, are you famous? And you go, well, no. Obviously not. You know. So there's sort of like, there's the embarrassment in that, but there's also, I think that one of the hardest things that you can do is admit to yourself what your dreams are. And it's like one of those things where you kind of like, you know, you say to yourself, oh, well, I want to be an actor. I don't just want to be an actor. I want to be a successful actor, you know, or I want to be famous, or I want to be the best comedian in the country. I want to be whatever, and whatever your dream is. And the first thing you do is you kind of like go, yeah, well, that's not a thing. How do I just sort of like go about my daily? And dreams are really easy to put up on a shelf and just sort of like admire until they're not relevant anymore. Until that moment has passed. And I think one of the hard things to do is to sort of like say, no, this is what I want to do. I've got one shot at this. It's this window of my life and I'm going to really go for it. And I'm going to try and make something of this. And either it works or it doesn't. But like, I think that the important thing is that you tried. And people always used to come up to me saying, oh, fucking hell, you're brave being a comedian, aren't you? That's like the hardest job in the world. And I would be like, yeah, I think it is hard, but it is scary. But I always found what was scarier was the thought of getting to the end of my life on my deathbed and thinking I never did it, I never tried. And so I do find stand-up scary, but I also find the prospect of not doing stand-up scarier. So I went for the less scary. I'm a coward. I went for the less scary option, which was getting up and doing it, you know?
Nick Helm, that seems like such a perfect place to end our conversation. I've really loved it. Thanks so much for spending time with me.
Thank you for asking me. That's very good.
You're welcome, my friend. And good luck with the tour, mate. It's brilliant.
Great. Thank you very much. It was lovely to see you again.
And another episode is done. What did I tell you? What a lovely, grounded, but very sensitive man I think Nick Helm is. And I'm thrilled that he came and I loved that chat. As I said, you know what I'm like, I don't do plugs. No one asks me, when people ask me to do the plug-in, I just go, I just go to somebody else's podcast or someone, you know, there's other people that do that. What have we become is Nick Helm's stand-up tour show that you can go and catch right now. Google it. If it's near you, go. It is a good night out, and my God, you get your money's worth. It's not just a straight 1 hour. You know, he comes on, you've got an interval, you've got more. It's fantastic. And hopefully, after you've heard this podcast now, you'll go and get some tickets. I would. I did. And I really enjoyed it. I can heartily recommend it. So, what else have we got to say? Not a lot, because obviously you can hear in my voice, I'm quite tired. I'm going to go to bed very soon. But thank you for being so patient and hanging in there. The podcast will be coming back, as I said, on a more regular basis very, very soon. So keep the faith, Lord. This has been going 5 years. We're not dropping out now. And we've got some good guests coming up that you are not going to want to miss. We are going to bow out season 10 as we started, as we always start, and as we always end on a massive high with brilliant guests, with conversations that you're not hearing anywhere else. And if you feel like you can support us, then go to patreon.com/thetwoshotpod. And you know what? If you want something else, we've got hoodies, we've got t-shirts, we've got mugs, we've got stickers. But do you know what? It's getting a bit colder. Maybe those lovely, toasty, soft hoodies have got your name written all over it. And if that's the way you want to support us, I'm not going to hold you back. You do that. I heartily recommend the grey. It's so soft and it looks very cool. As ever, You can support us on all the social medias. Shout us out, tag us in. We're Twitter, we're Facebook, we're Instagram at @twoshotpod. And it's twoshotpod@gmail.com if you want to drop us a line. Right. You do whatever you need to do. And I'm going to go to bed. And until I see you again, which will be very soon, I promise. I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the very welcome return of the Two Shot Podcast. Take it easy. The Two Shot Podcast was presented by me, Craig Parkinson. Recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. The remix of our theme tune is by Stolen Velour. Cheers. Out of the fire.